Good evening, everyone. Welcome to The Authentic Woman. This is your host, Shannon Fisher. Thank you for joining us on this lovely Sunday night. Hopefully a lot of people are snowed in and tuning in and listening. It's been quite a week on the East Coast, so it's 8 o'clock. We're doing a live show tonight, 8 o'clock East Coast time. So for the West Coasters and anyone else who's listening, I hope you guys are warmer than we are. But we all have power, and we're excited to dive into this topic tonight. The name of tonight's show is The Centennial Rally for Equal Rights, History Meets Politics. And I've got three amazing guests, all of whom have been actively involved in government relations for decades, and they are ardent advocates for the Equal Rights Amendment, and they are in the process of planning a series of events to commemorate a very historic event in women's rights. About 100 years ago, at the Virginia Capitol, there was a large rally for women's suffrage, and they are going to reenact that of sorts and surround some events around that to really raise awareness of the Equal Rights Amendment and of a lot of women's rights issues that still exist. My guests tonight are Donna Gramsci, Candy Graham, and Eileen Davis. Donna is a member of the League of Women Voters, and she has been, she lived in a state where the Equal Rights Amendment was ratified. So she moved to the Commonwealth of Virginia in the 1980s and was shocked to learn that it hadn't been ratified in Virginia, and it still hasn't. So she was moved to join the League of Women Voters shortly after her arrival. And now she is the director, the chair of women's issues for the League of Women Voters. My other two guests, Candy Graham and Eileen Davis, are two of the co-founders of Women Matter, which is an organization dedicated to the ratification of the ERA in Virginia. And Women Matter is also a part of the national coalition working with Congress to advance the ERA. So without further ado, I would like to welcome all three of you to The Authentic Woman. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Shannon. It's wonderful to be here.
So before we dive into kind of talking about the progression of the issues over the last 100 years and what's going on right now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the series of events that you guys are planning that are coming right up. So if you guys could tell me the date and the event and what's going to happen during, especially the reenactment of the rally, that would be great. Eileen, you want to start?
I'll let Candy do that.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, this started when one of our members found a photo of the suffragists on the Capitol steps in Richmond that dated back 101 years ago. We're holding the rally on February 16th. Which is also right around what we call crossover day in the Virginia General Assembly, and we can explain the significance of that a little bit more. But at the time, this was in 1915, so the suffragists are advocating for women's right to vote, which didn't actually, that 19th Amendment didn't actually get ratified until 1920, and in Virginia, it didn't get ratified until 1954. Now we are trying to continue this unfinished business because the right to vote, the 19th Amendment, is almost exactly like the Equal Rights Amendment, equality of rights versus the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And so this was supposed to be part B, but now 100 years later, we're still trying to get the Equal Rights Amendment ratified. So we are using this historic occasion to rededicate ourselves to this initiative. And we have the bill before the Virginia General Assembly to ratify the ERA. Virginia is one of the states that did not ratify. It has passed in the Virginia General Assembly, in the Senate, four out of the last 5 years, each time that it was introduced, with bipartisan support. And we are coming up to a vote most likely on Tuesday. We expect it to pass in the Senate again. The real pushback that we get is from the one person who is the chair of the Privileges and Elections Committee in the House, and he refuses to docket the bill. He says that the deadline expired in 1982, and so it's unlawfully before the Virginia General Assembly. And there are several legal reasons cited in the Congressional Review Service report that contradict that. And that's included in the language of the bill. And we've presented that every year to every legislator. So we've got one man trying to block democracy. We're hoping that this rally will draw so much attention and shine a light on what's happening and give us that push that we need to get him to docket the bill and give us the dignity of the debate.
Now, for the listeners out there who aren't really aware of the progress of the Equal Rights Amendment and the historical progression and how it was ratified by Congress and the state ratification process, let's stop and kind of address that since we're talking about that. Donna, do you want to jump in and talk a little bit about the debate surrounding the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s and how we got to the point where Virginia is still attempting to ratify it?
Well, as of right now, 35 states have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. We need three more states, and Virginia is one of the pivotal states that we feel we have a chance in. Back when I moved to Virginia, which was in 1978, as I said, the states that I had lived in, New York, Connecticut, Maryland, they had all passed the Equal Rights Amendment with very, very little problem. When we tried to push for the Equal Rights Amendment to be passed in Virginia, we came up against certain arguments, such as women would therefore be drafted and would have to serve in combat. That there would be unisex bathrooms, all sorts of issues that really were beside the point. But more importantly, many of the things that people argued against in Virginia when we tried to talk with them to get the legislation passed in this state have come to fruition without any Equal Rights Amendment being passed. Women now can serve in the military, they can serve in combat if they are qualified for the jobs. There are unisex bathrooms, there are family bathrooms, and in many places there are unisex bathrooms. When we were trying to push for ratification in the state of Virginia, we did everything that we could think of. And we would line the walkway between the General Assembly building and the Capitol and have silent vigils almost daily to try to inspire legislators to pass the legislation in this state. And we went to certain legislators, one happening to be a freshman delegate, and he quite frankly said to me, this is not an atmosphere that the Equal Rights Amendment can be passed. And I swallowed. And then he said, what can I do? What issues do you want me to help you work on until the atmosphere is right? And we were able to pass three major pieces of legislation, but they were piecemeal and they could go mm-hmm. away. You know, the atmosphere is right now, and that's why we are rededicating ourselves to seeing it pass in the state of Virginia. Although we were pleased with those pieces of legislation, the work is not done, and none of that is protected by the United States Constitution. When people ask me why I care so much, and I've been working on this for so many years, I say I want my daughter, my daughter-in-law, and my granddaughters to be mentioned in the United States Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why
mm-hmm.
I'm working.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
You know, Shannon,
you've been doing it for
I'm
a long time. So, Eileen.
I'm listening to what they're. Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
Yeah.
All three of the women on this call are all come here to Virginia. All three of us came here and found out that we were now living in an unratified state, and we were all kind of like, "Are you serious right now? Are you kidding me?" And then we all mm-hmm. found ourselves, you know, coming in from another state and taking a look around and going, "Wait a minute, we're in a situation and we're in a place where we need to do something, because now we're here and we're implanted in a place where we can do something." So it's kind of interesting that all three of us came from ratified states and came down here and looked around and said, "Wait a minute." And I think a lot of the women that live in the state of Virginia are like frogs in water. They just kind of accepted that this was the way it was here. And part of what our job is to really have an awakening to the women that live here. I was at an event about 3 weeks ago, and I was talking to this woman, and she said to me, she goes, "You know, I worked on the Equal Rights Amendment about 30 years ago." So this is a woman at a Republican event. And she says, and one of the delegates patted me on the shoulder and said, "Now, Betty, you know that Virginia men will always take care of their women." And that's the kind of atmosphere that Donna was talking about, the idea of that perpetual paternalism, that, you know, they don't understand why we're not grateful for that. But, you know, really, only infants and the infirmed need to be taken care of. And what the women in this state are doing is they think that they're equal because, you know, we've come a long way. And when Donna talks about the laws that she got passed, they were great. But, you know, they were great and they were necessary and they helped a lot. But a lot of those incremental laws have actually muddied the water and left an entire generation of women thinking that this problem is no more. But the Constitution
let's rewind a little bit. Let's rewind a little bit mm-hmm. to the time when the Equal Rights Amendment was actually proposed, which was so long ago that it is mm-hmm. mind-boggling mm-hmm. that we're still dealing with the same issues. So tell me a little bit about the history of the bill itself.
Well, you know, the original activity for equal rights started in the 1850s with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and it bears one of the interesting things about our rally is that Elizabeth Cady Stanton's great-great-granddaughter, who runs the Stanton Trust in Connecticut, is coming down to be a guest at our rally and talk about her great-grandmother's, you know, long-term vision for full inclusional equality for women in the United States Constitution, and how her great-grandmother would be absolutely staggered to know that it still isn't done. So we're really, really thrilled that she's coming down. We are also, but when she did that, when you have to remember, all of this has taken a long time. You know, the Declaration of Sentiments was written in 1848. Women didn't get the right to vote until 1923, I believe it was finally signed by Congress, or finally fully ratified. So the point is that was a very long struggle. Then we got the right to vote, and then as Candy touched on, you know, the state of Virginia didn't even, like, surrender to the fact that the federal 19th Amendment was in place and vote on it in the General Assembly until 1954. I mean, let that sit there for a minute. 1954, they didn't finally surrender to what happened in 1923. So here we are now. We had Congress ratify the Equal Rights Amendment in 1972. And it's interesting to note that Hawaii ratified the amendment 42 minutes after it passed. And here we are in 2016, and Virginia is still circling the drain on this. It's absolutely amazing to really kind of think about it, but that's the fact. But the reasons for not having the Equal Rights Amendment also has a very interesting history, because, you know, back in the 1800s, women, you know, women didn't own property. They were relegated to perpetual guardianship. They belonged to their male relatives, and we got to remember back in the day when the Constitution was even written, women were considered to be basically like a perpetual child. They never gained maturity. They never had any legal rights because it was like having a 10-year-old forever. You weren't expected to be able to take care of yourself or understand things. What Thomas Jefferson called the vagaries of politics. He didn't want women to vote because he didn't want women to bother themselves with the vagaries of politics. You know, and that's that nice guy, you know, sexism kind of thing. But then, you know, you go through the different generations, and the interesting thing is every generation has had its resistance to equal rights that the next generation looks back on and thinks is just downright silly. You know, they were in the 20s, they were worried about petticoat rule. Imagine that, petticoat rule. And it was also like, well, gosh, we gave you the right to vote. I mean, isn't that enough? Like, we women are never satisfied. And then you get into the Mad Men culture and, you know, the 50s and the 60s. And then, like Donna said, you know, it was built around, in the 70s, it was built around the draft, fear of female clergy. Women were going to lose their femininity and become lesbians. I mean, it was all kinds of craziness. And it's always amazed me that the idea of where people would empty their bladders when they weren't at home was a reason to not convey constitutional gender equality. It's always staggered me that that was actually a large part of the reason.
Sure, sure. And now let's go back to Candy. So, Candy, you're talking about the obstructions to the current challenges that we're facing. And so what is the argument that it is null and void? There was a deadline for state ratification, and it has passed. So tell me a little bit about the lobbying efforts that you guys are doing on various levels to get around that or to rectify that.
Right. Well, and it is correct that the deadline did expire in 1982. However, that deadline was an artificial deadline that was added in the resolving clause. It was not part of the language of the amendment, which was voted on and passed overwhelmingly in Congress back in 1972 with bipartisan support. So that's one thing that is mentioned by the Congressional Review Service report and is included in the language of the bill, and we bring that up every year. The other is the precedent of the Madison Amendment, which was introduced in the Madison administration and wasn't ratified until 203 years later. The third point that we mention is the fact that Congress has already demonstrated its full authority over the amendment process, which is granted them by Article 5 in the Constitution, back in 1978 when they realized that 35 states had ratified. They were three states short. They rescinded the deadline for 1979 and extended it to 1982. And one of the historians and ERA advocates, David Dismore, noted that had just 7 or 8 state senators in 3 states, North Carolina, Florida, and Nevada, had they changed their votes, then the ERA would have been fully ratified by 1979. We can't let 7 or 8 people that voted this way decades ago prevent us from having the Equal Rights Amendment in the 21st century. It's just crazy. And when we talk with our supporters and ask them, what do you think is the pushback? Why are they trying so hard to deny us our rightful place in the Constitution? And one of our supporters said, I think they feel like things are just moving too fast.
Yeah.
Right.
If I might jump in right there. Yeah. The thing is that, you know, Candy has just kind of explained to you all that wonky nonsense. And we have deluged them with facts. But don't get facts get in the way, you know. We have given them, we have a law school journal from William & Mary, and the title explains the content. It's Why the Equal Rights Amendment is Legally Viable and Presentable Before the States. We have given that to them. They're not. The people who oppose us haven't even read it. We've given them the Congressional Review Study. We've given them the argument that the, and by the way, it was a Democrat who put the deadline ratification on after the bill was voted on. So the ratification isn't even really, is questionably valid. And then we've talked to them about the idea that, you know, that the Madison Amendment, you know, again, the Constitution talks about parity in amendments. You can't have one amendment that's 200 plus years from start to finish go through, which, by the way, was a congressional pay raise, and then an equal rights amendment in the same generation, you know, sitting on ice after 10 years. It's just the argument of equal treatment is not there with how you go after pursuing amendments. But as Candy said, it's really just, they're just throwing us around. Really, this is a tried and true strategy. You know, they're masking the arguments. They're really afraid of social change. So
what
they do is
that is so true, because
yeah,
I remember right. In the 1970s, I remember testifying in front of one of the committees on a piece of banking legislation. And the chair of that committee actually looked at me and said, "Donna, don't worry your pretty little head. I know Joe. I've met him. And he's going to take care of you. You don't have to worry about this." And
mm-hmm.
I sat there with my mouth open. So I truly do believe that they are afraid that the world is going too quickly, and they don't want to be a part of that advancement. I truly do think that that's the,
mm-hmm.
because as Eileen said, they have been inundated with facts, with papers, with everything that you can think of. And I think the bottom line is change in Virginia is extremely difficult.
Well
Donna, you've been part of the League of Women Voters for all of these decades, and as you mentioned earlier, you were able to get some bills that forwarded women's equality through. So what was the legislation that you were able to get passed, even though they refused to pass the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, and again, it is piecemeal, and anyway, the three pieces of legislation, one was in the state of Virginia, if you died intestate, which means without a will, the children, if there were children, got 2/3 of the estate, and the surviving spouse got 1/3. And the League of Women Voters found this objectionable because most of the time the surviving spouse is female. And if somebody dies intestate, very often there is not a lot of money. Most of the time when someone dies, their children are older and are out on their own anyway. And the surviving spouse, whether it be male or female, should get the funds of the estate. And I remember one of the men said, well, maybe a woman wouldn't take care of her children. You know, maybe we shouldn't do this because if she gets the entire estate, then maybe she will not take care of the children. And I remember somebody countering that with, a male might do that, but a female would take care of her children. So it is now that if you die intestate, the surviving spouse inherits. The other bill that was so important was a banking bill. Long, long time ago, when you opened a joint bank account, there were cards that you filled out declaring what type of account you wanted to have. And if a couple set up a joint bank account, the bank did not want to get into any legal ease with that couple. So the way it was set up is that the person who put the money into the account is the person who actually owned the account. So they looked on an account that was owned by husband and wife, and if she wrote on any checks on it, she was considered an agent for him. And if the marriage dissolved, she did not own any part of that joint bank account. And this was
wow.
So bosses could have a joint account with a secretary. So it was set up
mm-hmm.
not intentionally to hurt women, but that is exactly what happened. And the third was we wanted marriage in Virginia to be viewed as an economic partnership. And so that if a marriage dissolved, at that point, if a woman chose to be a stay-at-home mom, you know, it usually was a joint decision, just the same way with the bank account bill. if the woman decided and the husband decided that she was going to be a stay-at-home mom, she did not, and she didn't make any money, she didn't own any of the property, whether it be a house or anything in the house. If she could not prove that she had purchased it with her money, she did not own it. Mm. And that came as a huge shock that this was the case in Virginia. And that didn't change until 1983. So, we looked at marriage as an economic partnership, and the understanding was that it was owned, the things were owned equally. In fact, back then, if a woman inherited a grandfather clock, unless she had the papers to prove that she had inherited that grandfather clock, there was a divorce, she did not have any say-so in getting that grandfather clock, which is just
that
mind-boggling.
That is phenomenal.
It's mind-boggling.
So this goes out to any of you. So what are the current reasons that we need the Equal Rights Amendment? What are the current economic and social situations that that women are still viewed as unequal, why we would need constitutional protection? That's any of you can jump in.
I can answer that from two of our students who are going to be speaking at the rally. Women Matter has a VCU chapter in Richmond, and one of them, Brandon, is an honors student. He's in the urban planning department there. He came with us last year to advocate at the General Assembly, and he said that, you know, he certainly sees this as a human right, and he hopes someday that he'll be married and he wants his wife to have equal rights and have full economic earning power, and it will boost their family income. He wants his daughters to have the same rights. But he said right now he's looking at graduation and he's thinking, why would anybody hire him if they can hire a woman with the same education and experience and pay her less? So that's certainly part of it. It goes to the point that what we're really fighting for is not just women's equal rights, but protection against gender discrimination. It cuts both ways. And the other student, Amanda, is president of I Am That Girl on the VCU campus, as well as a member of our Women Matter VCU chapter. And she said she pays the same tuition that the male students do, and yet she faces an 8 to 12% differential in earning potential when she graduates that only gets wider as she gets older. And that's going to impact her earnings over her lifetime, her ability to pay back her student loans, her family's income. And then at retirement, it's going to seriously impact her Social Security earnings for retirement. So those are just two of the economic reasons. There are other reasons, too. We need protection against gender violence in the military still and on college campuses. Those are just two more examples of, you know, how a ratified Equal Rights Amendment will undergird any legislation along those lines.
Yeah. What Candy is absolutely right. What we have here is, and I don't want to get too wonky in the weeds with the law, but what we have here is you have to understand that any constitutional principle, when you take a case to the Supreme Court, they look at it and they apply strict scrutiny. And they ask, what is the incremental law? What is the constitutional principle that's been violated? And when you look at those incremental laws like Title IX that Candy alluded to, and violence against women, and the Equal Pay Act of 1963, they're all weakly enforceable. And the reason that they're weakly enforceable is they're intermediate level law coming out of Congress, but they're sitting on no constitutional foundation. They're nails without a hammer. They're sitting there. They're walls. They're incremental law walls, but there's no foundation for them to sit on. And this is really kind of backwards. I mean, you're supposed to have, you know, the constitutional principle, and then the incremental laws of Congress sit on that constitutional principle. They're sitting on nothing. They're sitting on nothing. And Justice Scalia, and again, Candy gave you those numbers about the 8 to 10% pay differential first job out of college. That has been well documented by lots of different places. We have done our homework. The Economic Policy Institute has grafted for decades that this pay differential exists, and we know it exists. And what happens is that if a woman wants to go and seek redress, it's on her. It's on her because there's no real constitutional principle that's been broken. And in the current body politic, what has happened is we have a lot of different cases, the most notorious being recently being the Walmart versus Duke case. And the Walmart versus Duke was a class action suit where Betty Duke, an African-American woman, started a class action suit because she noted that at Walmart that 88% of the men, of the people that were managers were men, and about 2.3% of the managers, 88% of the workforce was women, excuse me, but 2% of the management force was women. So they're like, wait a minute, flag on the field. This is a disparity here. You know, we're almost 100% of the workforce, but yet we're only 2% of people that ever get off of just working as floor help. So they sued on systemic gender systemic. Well, when they went to the Supreme Court, though, the Supreme Court turned them away on the basis of equality because there is no gender equality clause in the Constitution. But they really wanted to take the case because it was the largest discrimination case, discrimination case to ever come before the court. So they put it in under the Commerce Clause. The problem is it really didn't fit the Commerce Clause. And that was all they had. It was the closest thing. It failed at the Supreme Court, not because they didn't have a complaint of gender discrimination, but because they didn't have a complaint that fit nicely into the Commerce Clause. So these people were turned away because what they sought, which was redress against gender discrimination, was not something that the Supreme Court could take. And that it's also bear remembering, a lot of people think that the Lilly Ledbetter Act took care of the problem of gender discrimination and women getting paid inequitably in the workplace. The Lilly Ledbetter Act is actually really an example of the problem, because the reason that the Lilly Ledbetter Act is an act, it's a congressional act, is because Lilly Ledbetter took her complaint to the Supreme Court and was turned away. And she was turned away, and Scalia was asked at a college, Hastings College, why he was against her. He voted against her in the Supreme Court, why he voted against Lilly Ledbetter when she went to the Supreme Court. And he said, you know, the Constitution does not prohibit against gender discrimination. I was under no obligation to do so. So what we're dealing with now is women are going and working and going to all different, you know, kinds of little areas of the work. But it reminds me of that old saying, the higher you climb, the harder you fall. You know, women are going all through, and they don't realize that they are not on equal footing, that they don't have the Constitution behind them. And then people say, well, we've got these incremental laws. Well, anything less than the Constitution is simply less. And that gets
sure.
to the idea.
Scalia said that equal rights, it's not that they're not guaranteed, it's that they're not it's not prohibited to discriminate on the basis of gender, and that is a very strong statement.
Exactly. Because he had some cheeky female law student ask him how he could dare to explain himself as to why he would turn Lilly Ledbetter away, and he basically said, "Because I could. I don't have to stand on the constitutional principle of equality because there is none. So, you know, gender equality is not in the Constitution. I was under no constitutional obligation to decide for her." So the Lilly Ledbetter Act is really, in effect, a consolation prize. And the other men benefit too. Men benefit from the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, they don't benefit. There's not as many reasons why they need it, but when they need it, they need it. There's a case right now in Utah, which is just hit the papers about 3 weeks ago. There's a law in Utah that says, and what happened was this 20-year-old couple, unmarried, had a baby. Well, the young woman, puts the baby up for a blind adoption. And the 20-year-old man is like, I don't want a blind adoption. I don't want this child to be given to a family and I never know where it is, where it ends up. I have no contact. I don't want to do that. And Utah set law doesn't care. Utah law says that the male parent has no rights unless he's married to the female. to stop that adoption. Now, you know, in Virginia, that happens to not be legal, but the point of the matter is that would be completely unconstitutional under an Equal Rights Amendment. So there is reasons why that, you know, why men benefit, you know, from a ratified Equal Rights Amendment. A lot of the reasons why men needed an Equal Rights Amendment have been resolved. When they thought the Equal Rights Amendment was going to come in the 70s, it's interesting. They fixed all the things that bothered men, like when a male survivor couldn't get Social Security for his deceased wife, nor could the children. If a woman who worked and paid into Social Security died, the children received no benefits from their dead mother, none. It was only that, even if she paid, it didn't count. So, and that didn't get corrected until SCOTUS went, Wiesenthal went to the Supreme Court, and actually Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued that case. A woman died in childbirth in New Jersey, and the husband with the surviving infant went to get Social Security for the child and couldn't get it. But that was something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued in New Jersey back in the 70s. So a lot of those piecemeal laws were taken care of for men, but we still have these outlying laws like this adoption case in Utah. So men do benefit. Men also benefit by the fact that when their partner, you know, it's an economic kitchen table issue. You know, there's 77 cents on the dollar sitting on the kitchen table from half of the marital partnership. That's a bottom line issue. That's a lot of money, and it can be a lot of money. And so that's an issue. It's an issue for families. And frankly, it's also an issue of what's right. Women
definitely,
are the only
definitely.
Group that the Constitution doesn't recognize. You know, well, gender. Gender is the only class that is not equalized. Gender is, as Scalia said, you are not under obligation to treat people equally based on their gender. I mean, if you sit and think about that for a minute, it's just, it's a staggering thing that that still is not done. It's really, really
it
staggering.
It really is. It is.
It is
mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Now, let me go to Donna for a second. Now, you've been
yes.
involved in the League of Women Voters for a really long time, and so I'm wondering your take on why the sudden resurgence in the, or what appears to be a sudden resurgence in the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, because it was something that was kind of just simmering for a number of decades, and laws were being passed bit by bit, the Paycheck Fairness Act, going before Congress, and then state laws. So to what do you attribute the resurgence of interest in putting this in the Constitution?
Well, I can tell you that it has always been part of the handbook, if you will, of positions with which the League of Women Voters will advocate and lobby. So it has never, that has remained one of our strongest positions. But for some reason, this past year, a number of us in the Richmond League looked at each other and said, we've got to do something about this. The League had proposed nationally and statewide looking at some other issues. And quite frankly, to be very, very honest, a number of us in the Richmond League did not feel that our efforts would be served to be working on studying those issues. We usually study issues for 2 years and then come up with consensus with which we develop positions, and then that allows us to lobby and advocate. And we just looked at each other and said the League was started based on getting women the right to vote. And voting has always been a primary part of the League of Women Voters. And we just decided it was time to re-look at this issue again and push for this again. And so we brought it up to the State League in Virginia, and they said, go for it, you know. And so we have been looking at it again and strategizing with Women Matter and AAUW, the American Association of University Women, and that has come to the fruition of this rally where all these groups are working toward making it happen. But it was just sort of something generic or you know, just organic that came out of a group of us in the Richmond League saying, hey, we need to go back to this because that's what was our foundation. That's what we started
Excellent.
With. And yeah, even though those pieces of legislation were passed in the 70s, as Candy and Eileen have said, they are piecemeal. That's all they are. There is no teeth in them. If you had a change of outlook in the Virginia General Assembly, those laws could go, you know, could disappear because there's nothing in them that is protected by the United States Constitution. So,
yeah, constitutional rights are conveyed from one generation to another. You know, as we look at the, when we even just look at the way the Gore's Amendment has evolved, you can see the frailty of not having something enshrined in the Constitution. I mean, it's amazing to know that the Equal Rights Amendment was really basically came out of the Republican Party. And it's amazing to know that the ratification deadline that was meant to be a poison pill was put on there by a Democrat from North Carolina, Sam Irwin from Watergate fame. And now today, the Republicans are the ones largely, and particularly in the House of Delegates, that are stonewalling the Equal Rights Amendment, and it's the Democrats that are championing the bill. So you can see the way generationally, you know, the vulnerability of laws that can be voted in and voted out and voted in and voted out. But I wanted to go back to an earlier point to just make a clear in terms of this kind of like this dance around the maypole that we're getting. Because they're working really, really hard to admit that this is not just cultural fear of social change. You know, we go up to Congress and we talk to them about removing the ratification deadline because we also have bills in Congress to lift the ratification deadline. But we're not at the General Assembly. We're up there. And what they say to us up there is very clearly, they go, bring us a freshly ratified state. We need an actionable reason to remove the deadline. We haven't had a ratified state in 30 years. Bring us a freshly ratified state and give us a reason to remove the ratification deadline and press the reset button. And then I say to them, well, the state of Virginia wants you to lift the ratification deadline first. And they go, no. This is a state's rights issue. The state does its job. We do our job. And then if the courts want to get involved, the courts can do their job. Their attitude is that they need an actionable reason to remove the deadline and that the state, I mean, Virginia fought a war over state's rights, and now they're telling us that they can't act without Congress's permission? I mean, it's ludicrous.
Sure.
It's ludicrous. And Congress is saying, oh, no. They're just giving you a reason. And that's the part I think is the most maddening. You know, this is a tried and true strategy. They've done this many, many times. You know, you take this, you say, oh, no, I'm not against equality for women. Oh, not me. I'd love to vote for it, but I just can't. They hide behind this constitutional purity and this scholarly minutia of law because they don't want to say that they're culturally afraid of the change, because that is something that they would not be able to defend. And that's why they stonewall us in the House of Delegates. And it's interesting, the Virginia Senate, which is a room full of lawyers, they pass it every year. The room full of lawyers all understand that this is perfectly within their legality to vote on this. And we pass it with bipartisan support. And then we go over to the House of Delegates, which doesn't have a lot of lawyers. Most of them are like business people in rural Virginia, you know, who own feed stores and insurance companies and, you know, family businesses. And, you know, and they come to Richmond for 2 months a year and they make laws. They seem to be the ones who are so stuck off in the weeds, and they don't understand that the lawyers on the other side of the chamber can vote for this. But somehow they say that their constitutional purity says that they can't. They're really just hiding behind this as a minutia of law. They're putting it up as a smokescreen. And every year we just fight a little bit more.
Yeah, talking about the diversity of the people who do support it,
mm-hmm.
at the events that you're planning next month, you've got a huge cross-section of people. So, Candy, if you could tell me a little bit about the list of people that are speaking and the different organizations that are involved in the different, I mean, you've got up to the governor of Virginia. So tell me a little bit about what's going to be addressed and what people are going to be talking about.
Yeah, it is really exciting to have the governor speaking, because I'm sure you remember, Shannon, 3 years ago when women were not only not allowed on the Capitol steps, but were arrested for being on the Capitol steps by Capitol Police and riot gear. So we've really come a long way in a couple of years as far as that's concerned. So yes, we've got the governor, we've got the attorney general. Hopefully we have the lieutenant governor and at least the patrons of our bills in the General Assembly. That will depend on when they have to go into session. We have the Honorable Leslie Byrne, the former U.S. representative and first woman elected to Congress from Virginia. As Eileen mentioned earlier, we have Colleen Jenkins, the great-great-granddaughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. We have Desiree Jordan, who is also from a ratified state, the state of New York. She's coming down. Andrea Miller, the executive director of People Demanding Action, who will speak to the fact that Congress is waiting for the next ratified state to act. We have our students coming to talk about how they're impacted. We did have a representative from Black Lives Matter, but she has a job that's going to conflict with the time of the rally, so unfortunately we won't hear from her. Let's see, who else do we have? We have a military veteran who is coming to speak, who testified before the Senate committee last week, and just amazing testimony. We invited Senator Ben Cardin, who is co-patron of the bill in Congress in the Senate, to remove the deadline, co-patron with Senator Mark Kirk from Illinois. And they are not able to come. We have a letter from Senator Cardin that we're going to be reading. We have Ellie Smeal and Terry O'Neill, kind of representing the old guard. We have some young women from groups that are just starting up in our Virginia colleges, who, when they learn that they're not part of the Constitution, they are shocked and outraged. And this is part of the issue, too, that it has taken so long to ratify. Most people assume it already has been ratified. And so when they find out that it has not, then we are starting to build momentum again. One of our friends who lives in the Roanoke region is the legislative chair for the Greater Federation of Women's Clubs in her area. And the women's clubs in Virginia have taken the ERA as a legislative priority. And that will be their lobby day when we have the rally. So having them come from the rural areas of Virginia and speaking to their legislators and saying that it's important to them to be protected by the Constitution is huge. I just can't even tell you how
those delegates
big this
in these small towns are going to be hiding under their desks when we get done with them.
We hope.
We hope. And Candy brought up a very important point. 72% of Americans think that the Equal Rights Amendment is already in the Constitution, and 97% think that it should be. So really, we're asking the Virginia General Assembly to do something to help make the United States of America the country that most Americans think it already is, and even more Americans think it should be. And it doesn't really won't cost anything. We're not asking them to vote on something with a budget. We're just asking for them, and if there is any cost to the Equal Rights Amendment, the cost would be a positive, because when women are paid what they're worth, they don't need, you know, if you ever have a wage gap, that wage gap's got to be filled somehow. And that wage gap is filled by government programs. And women deserve the dignity of standing next to men and making what men make and not having to get a government program to subsidize their artificially depressed income. So in terms of what the General Assembly is supposed to vote on, which are fiscally helpful to taxpayers, it's fiscally helpful to taxpayers to raise women up, because a rising tide raises all boats. So
and
on every
Shannon,
level,
for the people
what they're fighting.
Shannon, the people who are listening out there, what can they do if they want to participate in the fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, be it in the Commonwealth of Virginia or on a national level? What can the average citizen do to help make this happen?
Well, first thing they can do is they can pull out their cell phones and they can text ERA to 52886. That's text the three letters, ERA, and send it to 52886. That will roll them into a national petition, and they enter their zip code, and it will tell them who their senator and who their congressperson is. And at that point, they basically, it will automatically send a letter to that congressperson and that senator. And if the congressperson or senator is already co-sponsoring those bills and has supported them in the past, they will get a thank you for supporting. Yeah, high five, keep doing it. And if they haven't signed on to the bill and they're not supporting it, they're getting a, I want you to sign under the bill. So people who live in ratified states need to understand that they need to help the unratified states because, you know, all our wagons are hitched together. Now, if anybody mm-hmm. listening has family in Virginia, or we ask people to call in. Last year, the House of Delegates didn't even want to put the bill in a subcommittee, and we had a national call campaign into Speaker House, William House, off phone, and the chair of the committee that's stonewalling, Delegate Mark Cole's phone, and their phones were so jammed that they put us in subcommittee just to make the phone stop ringing. We got into the subcommittee and they turned us down, but they couldn't ignore us. And that's part of what we're doing. We're building a momentum to let them know we're not going away. You know, if not now, when? 100 years is long enough. And that is, again, the byline of our rally. 100 years is long enough. We're going to make them not ignore us. So there are things, the people that don't live in Virginia need to understand that their state may have ratified 30 years ago. But they're sitting in a ratified state stuck in limbo because the Commonwealth of Virginia is trying to take its time. And I do believe the state of Virginia will finally do the right thing, just like it took them forever. You know, Virginia takes its sweet time. Eventually, though, it does the right thing. Eventually, they will do this. I'm just wondering, you know, when that's going to be. But eventually, it will happen. But if we get momentum, you know, public and also tell people, everybody on this call, you know, tomorrow over the water cooler, look at the people you work with and say, do you know the equal rights amendment is not in the Constitution, that the Constitution does not guarantee gender equality between the sexes? And they're going to look at you and go, oh, sure it does. I remember my mom marched for that and they got that. Well, yeah, well, where did you grow up? Well, I grew up in Connecticut. Well, then you're right. They did ratify it, but it never finished becoming a constitutional amendment. Did you know that? So the things that plagued us a generation ago have completely changed. Women in the military, check. Unisex bathrooms, check. You know, all those kinds of things. What we have now is two problems. We have the inertia that comes from nothing happening for 30 years, and inertia can be a powerful force. And the other one is the lack of information and the misinformation. And any person who goes to our website, women-matter.org, and all that we set up as an information website. Take the time to read it. There's a couple of easy 3-minute videos that are quick tutorials on the subject. Spread the word, raise the awareness, because our biggest enemy is lack of information. That's our problem.
And also right at the top of your website, there's a button to click that will take you to all of the information about the rally. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, and you can also sign the state petition, and the text DRA to 52886. It's all on our website. And if you want to learn more, we had Michigan contact us the other day. Michigan ratified the Equal Rights Amendment a bazillion years ago. But, you know, a woman in Michigan contacted us and said, can I send you money to help pay for your rally? I mean, you know, people around the country that are paying attention are thrilled that we're trying to move it along because, you know, they've been frustrated because they know, the people that know it's never done, never been finished, are kind of like, oh, come on, what's Virginia waiting for? You know, well, Virginia's waiting like it did with the right to vote, I guess. But, you know, enough is enough. It's time. It's time.
And
our hashtag is because of the 60s.
And for years, people within Virginia legislature have said to us, well, the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution covers you and takes care of you. And then if you point out to them, then why do we need the 19th Amendment to get the right to vote? And they just stand there staring at you. You know,
The other thing is that there's lots of case law, and the more, you know, if I keep this up for two more years, they're going to have to give me an honorary law degree. One of the things first of all, I just go right to Scalia. I'm like, you don't have to take my word for it. Scalia says it. So, you know, Scalia says it, and Ginsburg says the same thing. Now, those two can't agree on order pizza for lunch, but they agree up equal rights amendment is, you know, that gender equality is not in the Constitution. But, you know, here was a case in 1948. This is an interesting case, and there's been lots and lots of cases of gender equality. But this is, I like the 1948 case because it's so clear. Now, remember, 1948 is post-World War II. It's after the 19th Amendment has been, you know, and it's post-World War II. A Michigan woman was a barmaid, and she went to bartending school, and she went to get a job as a bartender in Michigan. Well, just like there's that funky law in Utah about adoption law, well, there was this funky law in Michigan that said you couldn't work as a bartender if you were a woman unless your father or your husband owned the bar. Well, she sued for gender discrimination, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and she was suing, claiming gender equality under the 14th Amendment. They turned her away, and they said that they did so. The decision included the fact that the 14th Amendment did not include gender discrimination. They said that, and that's 1948. They said that. Now, the Constitution is unchanged with regards to women. It hasn't changed anything. The only thing that's passed since then is the, you know, nothing that has anything to do with women. You know, you got the Madison Amendment, which is a congressional pay raise, you got, but nothing. The laws, the rights that women have in the Constitution, which is the right to vote, has not changed. It's the same Constitution it was in 1948 when they made that ruling that the 14th Amendment did not include gender equality. It did not include. And when you go back to the 14th Amendment, you remember that was a Civil War amendment. That was written after the Civil War to take the 3/5 of a person that was conveyed upon black men and make them full citizens. That was the Civil Rights Amendment. And it's interesting that, you know, the movie Lincoln was filmed in the Virginia General Assembly. And I always kind of like chuckle to myself in a very sardonic way when I'm walking through the General Assembly, because they filmed it in that. And if you remember in that movie, when they were talking about passing the 14th Amendment, and then one of the people that didn't want it said, well, what's next, rights for women? You know, if they had known that anybody was going to try to say that the 14th Amendment conveyed rights to women, it would have never passed. It would have never been. They never intended it to be. And indeed, it does not.
Well, you know,
let's
not.
Say that. I was going to tell
about a friend of ours who pointed out that her grandmother, who served in the military years ago, wanted to be buried at Arlington Cemetery, and she cannot be. And I think that is just so sad. It's really outrageous that women veterans don't get the honor that they deserve.
Yeah, and that's a whole other cultural issue. I mean, I went to Normandy, France a couple of years ago, and walking around the cemetery, and I see a woman's name on a headstone, and I asked the docent, I said, that's a woman's name. Docent says, oh, there's 113 women buried in Normandy. I had to go all the way to Normandy, France to find that out. You know, the fact is women have died in every war there ever was, but, you know, we don't respect that part of our history. The narrative is that women have not paid the price for this country, but yes, indeed they have. Women have always paid the price for this country, but that's a narrative that we don't really stress. You know, there's a change.org petition right now about women pilots in World War II not being able to be buried in Arlington Cemetery, because a lot of these old ladies are now passing away. You know, these are women pilots who faced combat, and they are not being allowed to be buried there, and it's absolutely unfair. But this is part of this is all part of the whole narrative of the fact that we're supposed to be, you know, this sort of this cultural pushback that men own all of that, you know, the ability to be. And, you know, women have died. I mean, and the idea that the women that died in Normandy, a lot of them were there as nurses. A lot of them were there as volunteers. They were there for little to no pay. Many of them volunteered. They weren't drafted. They went there voluntarily. They died. Dead is dead. Their families had just as much of a dead child as any other gender, and history has absolutely ignored them and then turned around and said, you can't be buried in Arlington, even though you gave your life for your country. I mean, there were so many levels.
Would the ERA rectify that? Would the ERA,
that's a good
if
question.
It were passed, would it rectify the Arlington issue?
You know, I don't know, because you're not a living person at that point, so I don't know. Certainly one could, you know, I think it's going to be rectified because the public's going to be outraged enough and they're going to have to rectify it. But that's the culture in which we live, where the idea that somehow, you know, we don't really want to do that. We've never done that. And somehow what the contribution of women just doesn't meet the bar of equality. And that's a larger cultural narrative that we're fighting. And the idea that, you know, women in World War II, like this woman's mother, wanted to be buried in Arlington. You know, these women were in combat zones. Many of these women pilots, you know, a lot of them died. And, you know, dead is dead. They died serving their country. And for some reason, and again, it goes back to that nuance of cultural sexism that is so, and another person, I wanted to give you another point, and is a person said to me, well, you don't really think that a ratified equal rights amendment is going to cure sexism, do you? Well, of course not. The, you know, constitutional prohibition of racial discrimination hasn't cured racism, but we know where the floor is. The Constitution has taken a stand. We have a bar to measure up to. You know, with respect to gender equality, there is no such constitutional principle to even begin to find equality. And that's really,
right.
That's probably the part that's the worst.
So a lot of people say that the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment at this point is merely symbolic, but I think that's not true, because we have to have that foundation on which
mm-hmm.
to build, like you said, the constitutional base for the laws to be built on top of that can genuinely address the discrimination. Well, unfortunately, our time is up. We've filled an hour. It's gone by so quickly. Donna, Brent,
thank you.
Graham, Eileen, Davis, both from Candy and Eileen from Women Matter, women-matter.org, and Donna Gransky from the League of Women Voters. And if you're listening on BTR, I put a link to the rally page on the broadcast page. If you're listening via iTunes or anything else, go to that Women Matter website, and it will take you to all of the details. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon.
Shannon.
Good night, everyone.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Are we there? Are we out?